versus pick.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, may I please the court? My name is Rex Motes of Motes Law Firm. I represent Michael Pick in this matter on appeal from the Washington County District Court. This matter arises out of a covenant dispute, for lack of a better term. I have six issues that I pointed out in my brief. I'd like to focus on the first issue and the last issue. Both are convenient exit ramps for this case, if I might. And specifically, with respect to the Bill of Exceptions, Volume 2 in this case, if the court would pay specific attention to Exhibits 26 and 27. Exhibit 26 is the covenants that are issued in this case. Exhibit 27 is the plat that was filed in this case. Specifically, I would refer the court in Exhibit 27 to the filing date of the covenant plat, which is March 28, 1975 at 1:18 p.m. I then would refer you to Exhibit 26, which are the actual protective covenants which show an April 18th, 1975, so almost 3 weeks later, 1:44 in the afternoon. And specifically with respect to Exhibit 26, it reads, for the purposes of providing adequate restrictive covenants for the mutual benefit of ourselves and successors entitled to the tracts hereinafter described, comma, we do hereby impose the following restrictions. There are no tracts of land in Exhibit 26 that are hereinafter described. Had they used the word herein before filed, this document is valid and binding. That's not what happened in this case. What happened is the plat was filed first, the covenants were filed second. The covenants make no reference to the property. We believe that raises the issue of standing and specifically subject matter jurisdiction in this case.
You raise that in the lower court?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Did you raise that with Judge Sampson?
Your Honor, as I'm sure the court is aware, this was a matter that was handled pro se by Mr. Pick in the lower court. It is not an issue that needs to be raised at the lower court, and this court or any subsequent court can pull that out as an exit ramp for this particular matter. You can't agree in court, and I think if you recall in the back and forth between Judge Sampson and my client, there was a specific question that was asked. Would you agree that these are applicable to your property? His answer in that particular inquiry from the judge doesn't cure the issue of standing in this case. It doesn't go away just because they think that that they do apply to them. It was easily curable in the beginning if they would have done a title search on each of the plaintiff's property and on the defendant's property to see whether or not those covenants run with and bind the land. That is not what happened in this case. These covenants were attached as an exhibit to the original a petition that was filed in this case. It is our opinion in our analysis of this that there is a significant standing issue here because the property that is at issue is not listed in Exhibit 26. Further to that, if you get through my exhibits or my points pointed out in my brief, the second matter that we point out was the issue of whether or not he should have been allowed to have a counterclaim. That was dismissal. The third was getting into the meat of the covenants themselves, whether or not there's a business here, whether or not there's noxious or offensive activity here, whether or not the definition of junk cars does or doesn't include trucks. Those are all great. They're great rabbit holes to go down, but the biggest issue in this case, in our opinion, is issue number one, the issue of standing. If you get through 2, 3, 4, and 5, I would point out that on Exhibit 6, that order is overbroad. The judge cannot change the covenants unilaterally by the stroke of his pen. And he did that when he limited Mr. Pick to three vehicles, Nowhere in the covenants does it say that. If they want to change the covenants, they need to go back to the property owners and use the mechanism that is available to them to change the covenant. You cannot do that by judicial fiat. That order is overbroad. It is overbroad, and it probably violates equal protection when you're going to allow some members of the community to have three cars, and anyone else can have an unlimited number of cars. So from that standpoint, it needs to be reversed and remanded with direction to the lower court. And we have given this court the opportunity to look at two fairly significant issues with respect to this standing issue. I was quite honestly shocked as I read the record, for the first time, that it wasn't picked out by counsel, that it wasn't picked up by the court. We had, researched the matter. I think if you see the Thompson v. Heineman case at 857 Northwest 2nd 731, which is a 2015 case, standing is a jurisdictional component of a party's case. Only a party that has standing has legal or equitable right, title, or interest in the subject matter of the controversy may use that tribunal. In opposing counsel's brief, they point out that, well, that district court would have the ability to hear an injunctive, a case for injunctive relief, a regular case under, I think, 251064, and that may be the fact, but that's not what was pled in the petition. That's not what was pled. They pled it as a case that had these covenants that were at issue, not a case under 251064. So from that standpoint, I agree that the district court could have heard that case, but they didn't do it. They didn't do it right. They didn't do it correct. There were ways to fix this, and it did not get done. I might also point out that standing is a component of subject matter jurisdiction, and this is an issue that cannot be waived. It cannot be waived. So from that standpoint, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, unless the court has questions.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Entwist.
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to start with the first assignment of error that the appellant dealt with, and I represent the 11 different appellees in this matter. And on the issue as far as the covenants and whether they are in full force and effect, this is a stipulation that both parties entered into fully and freely on the record. We are in the process of performing a title search, and then at a hearing on summary judgment, Mr. Pick agreed to stipulate that the covenants were in full force and effect and applied to all the parties, which was a big part of his waiver argument that my clients had also somehow breached these covenants. So at that time, we had stipulated to a key component that we needed to prove in our claim. So since there was a stipulation on the record and the district court entered an order, we didn't proceed any further to prove up the title searches because of the stipulation. And it is similar to a case if you stipulate to, say, damages, and then an order is entered noting stipulation for damages, and then on appeal, the appellant argues that, hey, wait a minute, you didn't prove damages. This is agreed to at the time. And
so where in the record is this stipulation? Was it at the beginning of the trial, before the trial started?
Or? Before the trial started. At the time, there was a summary judgment motion, and at that time, there was a stipulation entered into. I don't have the page number, but it's in the transcript.
Is it just oral and recorded, or was it a written stipulation that was signed by everybody?
There was a phone hearing after the summary judgment motion, and then those just signed by the judge, but the parties didn't individually sign. They agreed on the record. In
the phone conversation?
Yes.
All right, okay. And so that would have been how long before trial actually started?
Your Honor, I want to say it was around a year before it started.
So is the stipulation used at the summary judgment hearing automatically admitted for purposes of trial?
Your Honor, the court took notice of the stipulation. I don't recall exactly how it was admitted at trial, but it was admitted that way at trial.
Were you trial counsel in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Looking to the covenants themselves, and they are indexed on all the lots. There's no question over what these lots apply to. As the exhibits mentioned, 26 and 27. 26 is the covenant. And I do agree. It says here and after described. And 27 is the plat showing all of the properties that these covenants apply to. And I agree it wasn't artfully crafted back in 1975. It doesn't change the fact that this covenants are indexed in all the lots and that the stipulation was agreed to. And pursuant to paragraph 10 of the covenants, any downstream assigned landowner in the subdivision has a right to bring an enforcement action for violation of the covenants against any other landowner.
Was the order entered by Judge Sampson overly broad?
No, Your Honor. So there's three components to the injunction that were entered, and they're all three are necessary to having a narrowly tailored injunction that will actually achieve compliance with the covenants. So first, there was a mitigation timetable in that appellant's property is just a sprawling junkyard. Over a discovery time, he counted 134 vehicles on his lot, and whole thing is covered. So with cars and other junk, so that timetable gave him over 4 months to clean that up. The second part of the injunction is the personal vehicle limitation. And the reason the personal vehicle limitation is needed is really needed to have the injunction be enforceable at all. Throughout the case, appellant referred to all the vehicles on his lot as his stuff. Initially, he stated that they're owned individually. Later, it turned out they're owned by his LLC, Main Street Motors, his used car business. So without any limitation on the personal vehicles on his lot, there'd be no way to enforce it. He would simply continue running the junkyard business. There'd be over 100 vehicles on his lot. He'd claim they were all his stuff, and he'd have to go through and look at each individual title to determine who he owns it, the LLC owns it, and frankly, no matter who owns the vehicles, they're all part of his business and in violation of the covenants.
But what about the equal protection argument that one of the other landowners in the subdivision can own or have one or two more vehicles than what's allowed to him?
Your Honor, I don't believe there be any equal protection issues as far as, I don't know if the appellant has any rights to have five vehicles instead of three, and I think there's no...
Well, the three vehicles was just three that could sit outside.
Yes, right. Your Honor, he also has a large barn shop on his property, and it's where he performs a lot of his work for his business, and presumably if he no longer had that for his business, he'd be able to store many vehicles on his property, his personal house garage, this barn, and three vehicles outside. So I don't think there's any, I don't know how many vehicles the appellant has, but I think he could store a good number of them on his property.
But he can only have three stored outside, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can the neighbor next door have four stored outside? There's no restrictions on that neighbor, is there?
Yes, Your Honor, there is no restrictions. There would be a gray area if the neighbor's property, if there's an action to enforce the covenants against them, then we'd have the issue of whether their property with four vehicles was too many. But I guess the issue of three versus four, I think, is unimportant compared to the fact that right now there's over 100. And whether it's three or four, I don't think that would be a concern. It's as far as the injunction just trying to get that property back into compliance with the covenants.
And this is a situation that's been going on for quite a period of time, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor. So appellant moved into the property in 2010. And in 2011, that's when the neighbors started noticing these vehicles accumulating. And at that time, the appellees tried to work with Washington County zoning, and Mr. Pick was found guilty of zoning violations. He received two fines of $250 for those violations after a jury trial. And his own home testimony was that that did nothing to change his behavior, and the witnesses all said that his business operations has exponentially grown since the 2012 zoning violations. And that's kind of why the last part of the injunction is needed, a verification process. I think the appellant was hoping that this matter would go somewhere to those, and he could just pay a fine and keep on running his business in violation of the covenants. And there was mention in appellant's brief about the length, there being no length of time and how long it would take, or how long the appellees got to go on his property and verify. And I believe there's 7-day notice that the appellees would give to the appellant after the property had been cleaned up, give 7-day notice. And I can assure you that the appellees have no desire to stay on his property any longer than is needed to determine there's no longer a junkyard business going on. And it's fairly obvious from driving by whether there's still a junkyard there. So I don't think the issue of the length of the verification visit by the appellees is a problem. Briefly, I'd like to point out that looking at paragraph 3 of the covenants, appellant's brief references the ambiguity of the terms offensive, noxious, annoyance, and I'd like to point the court to the case of Estates versus Prairie Ridge v. Korth, which found the words nuisance, annoyance, and storage of obnoxious materials to be unambiguous. The use of subjective words does not make the covenants ambiguous. And the first part of Section 3 says no business, trade, or commercial activity. Appellant's brief skips over that portion, as there is no question that the appellant is running a junkyard business on his property in violation of the covenants.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Entwistle.
Yes, sir. Sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And then how much time does Mr. Motes have for rebuttal?
A total of 3 minutes, 11 seconds.
All right. Mr. Motes, you may approach.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Was there a stipulation?
It doesn't matter if there was or not, Your Honor. You can't stipulate to standing.
Can you stipulate to an underlying fact that would establish standing?
They had the opportunity to do that with the title report. If they would have simply gone out and got a title report and either attached it or entered it into the record, yes, they could have cured it. They didn't.
But if your client said, I'll stipulate to the fact that the covenants apply, I'm not going to make you go through that.
Can't,
is that not an enforceable stipulation?
No.
Why not?
Because you can't waive standing, Your Honor. You can't waive standing. And the judge should have known that, and counsel should have known that, and you've got a pro se.
Are you waiving standing, or are you just admitting that there is standing?
From the standpoint
of what your client, if that stipulation exists, is your client not stipulating to standing as opposed to waiving standing?
You can't waive standing. You can stipulate that these are the covenants in Exhibit 26 and 27 that are at issue here, but you can't waive standing.
And I mean, you can't stipulate that those covenants apply to my land?
And if you did, and it came here or across the hall, do you think that would pass muster? I think not. I don't think it would pass muster.
I don't think you can lay in the weeds. I don't think you can lay in the weeds and tell the opposing lawyer that you agree they don't have to establish this and put it on the record and then not do a title search and then come to us and say, silly him, believing my word when I said he didn't have to prove it, that we were agreeing to it.
It's pro se, Your Honor.
Well, that doesn't matter.
No, if it doesn't matter, then they would have gotten a title report and attached it to it, and it wouldn't have mattered what he said. He could have agreed that the moon was blue, but it wasn't. In this case, the covenants don't apply. There is no case beyond that. There's no description of the property that is encumbered. With respect to the point on the injunction here, which I have, paragraph D, page 14 of 15, the court acknowledges that under the Spring Valley Protective Covenants, there is no restriction on the number of personal motor vehicles, Perrin, automobiles, trucks, all-terrain, utility vehicles, tractors, riding lawnmowers, etc., that a person can possess on their Spring Valley property. That's Judge Sampson's order. I don't know how you reconcile that with now later in the order saying that he can only have three.
Well, Judge Sampson had to do something. I mean, this had been going on for years. For goodness sake, he had to put in some kind of a compliance.
Well, to my point on waiver that I pointed out in my brief, it's been going on for years, 10 years before anyone did anything and asked for any type of injunctive relief.
Well, there was proceedings in 2012. He had a jury trial, for goodness sakes.
He had a zoning. He was fined. He had a zoning issue.
Right. All related to this. To this issue. Right? This issue. Not some other issue. Not he was running a beauty school out of his place. He had a junkyard.
Junkyard, I think, is a term of art in this, and I will not bore you with the distinctions, but they're in my brief with respect to what they choose to call it and what it actually is. I would call it...
Or a used car lot.
Well, it's not that, Your Honor. I don't think that would withstand muster. It is not a used car lot.
Okay.
There's no cars that are sold there. Record's clear on that. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Motes. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Motes.
The case will be taken under submission. And the parties are excused. We are adjourned.